Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show with advice and insight into the technologies and practices currently being used to build web applications in the real world. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallen, and John Papa talk to industry experts about their experiences writing, deploying, and maintaining web applications in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to Real Talk JavaScript. This is episode 41, How to Manage Your NPM Dependencies. And this week I have both the co-hosts, Ward Bell and Dan Wallen. How are you both doing?
I'm doing
great. Phenomenal.
Dan, you sound like you're doing a heck of a lot better than Ward.
I didn't get enough sleep last night and it hasn't caught up, but talk to me later and I'll be like, Ward.
Well, just as an indicator of our difference, we're kind of here at Idea Blade, my consulting company. We're in a kind of a contract lull. I have some spare resource capacity. So I'm doing what anybody does under those circumstances, and I'm reading War and Peace.
Wait. If you've got downtime, why don't you spend some time driving down to Disneyland and go to Star Wars Galaxy's Edge? I know you could use that break.
Yeah. It's Star Wars or War and Peace. Have any of you ever read it? Jan, have you read it? Anybody read Ward? I don't run into anybody who's ever read it. They all like roll their eyes as I did. But here I am reading it, and believe it or not, it's a great book, just like they said it would be.
Yeah, I know. I've been telling you Star Wars is a great book for you.
No, John. Okay.
All right. So this week's topic is actually one that's very near and dear to me. It's we've all been living in the NPM JavaScript world for years, and there's always these constant discussions of how you manage your NPM packages or dependencies. So this week we have on a very knowledgeable guest, Jan. And Jan is a developer from Berlin, Germany. He works on Greenkeeper, CouchDB, and offline-first web technologies at Neighborhoodie. Sounds like a neighborhood that's a hoodie. That's cool. He's also the co-curator of JSConf EU, which ran for the 10th time this year. I hear good things about that one. And our topic this week, again, is managing your NPM dependencies. Thanks for coming on, Jan.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jan, I don't want to butcher your last name. I probably guessed pretty well, but go ahead and let folks know.
Cool. I'm Jan Lehnert. Nice to meet you all.
Yeah, it's good to meet you, too. And we first talked about Greenkeepers, how I think you and I met a couple months ago, probably back in February-ish. Is that right?
That sounds about right, yeah. You had a bunch of other folks from NPM on that talked about a lot of packages, and I thought this would be a good additional kind of topic exploration.
Yeah, it's one of the topics I'm really passionate about because we all write code. Like, as developers, we write the code all the time. We focus on the development, but we don't always focus on the stuff around it. And at a large corporation, which I've been at many times, this kind of thing can be painful. I was just talking to my friends yesterday at a large corp who were telling me they installed something, and it was like their internal teams, their like architecture teams, give them a set of node modules they have to use and dependencies. And once they installed it locally, it was 950 meg on a machine of node modules. And this was a real turnoff for some of the developers. And they're like, you know, trying to figure out how they can manage this. And is that even a problem? Do you see this a lot out there?
We definitely see people struggling with a vast amount, with varying degrees of policies in larger companies. And for smaller companies or individual developers, just finding the good modules, basically.
Yeah, I wonder too. I mean, Dan, you do a ton of JavaScript as well, and so do you, Ward. Have you ever taken a look at how big your projects are?
Yeah. Well, here's how I know. If I'm on a certain OS, which I won't name right now, but you'll probably guess, and I need delete node modules.
What's that, like OS2 from IBM?
Yeah, pretty much.
CPM.
Commodore 64 or something like that. But you know how big it is just by how long does it take to delete the dang node modules for? You know, you're just like, oh my gosh, delete, die, please.
Yeah, all right, so where do we experience it the worst is when we're standing up there at a conference and the Wi-Fi sucks and we're asking everybody to install something. But, you know, once you get past that, is it really a problem? Because it feels like FUD to me. There's a whole bunch of stuff sitting on my machine, but disk is cheap. It's not going over the wire. What's the big deal?
Yeah, and are you really NPM installing on the same project that often, like from scratch?
No.
I mean, I do it a lot when I add something new, but I don't tend to re-npm install. Although, let me amend that. There are times where I will wipe out my node modules folder mm-hmm. and my package lock because I want to go run like npm audit fix, and I want to get things updated to new modules, or I just want to make sure I got everything that's most recent. So, but maybe, I don't know. I don't know if I'm unique like that or if a lot of developers do that.
I just did that too, actually about 2 weeks ago. And that was the use case I was thinking of. And I agree with Ward. It's big, but I think take any other package framework out there, from .NET to Java to Ruby, whatever, the code's got to go somewhere is the bottom line. So whether it's, code to hit a database or more simple, just utility functions, think Lodash type things or whatever. I mean, the code's still got to go somewhere, right?
Well, and 99.99% of this is like artifacts that are never going to get in your way. They're just there in case you need to go find something. So I'm not troubled by how much there is. I'm troubled by what the hell is all of that and how does it intersect? It's version control that drives me crazy, or what even a version is. I don't even understand what a version is. Of course, I'm also always afraid that something that was safe last week is no longer safe. So I guess that's how we get the Greenkeeper.
Right. One of the things we started looking at, maybe let me do the origins of Greenkeeper. We were working on an open source project called Hoodie, which is where the company Neighborhoodie gets its name from. And one of the things we saw that drives adoption is chopping up the problem space that Hoodie was trying to do into lots of small modules. Because it is a web application framework for offline first web apps. But say somebody wanted to add password forget to the feature, to the account module or to the account part of the project. If it would be one big project, they had to learn everything about the project, like whatever lives, what the conventions are to write code for this, find all the tests and execute them and then figure out where to add the right tests and so on. And once we started like breaking things out into, say, an account module, then suddenly the surface area for people to get into the project was a lot smaller. They could quickly scan a README, see a bunch of tests, and see naturally where their addition would fit in. We took it to an extreme for a tiny open source project and suddenly had 50 node modules spread across our GitHub organization. And pretty quickly after that, we saw a big uptick in contributions, which was very, very nice. But then for us maintainers, the main job that we had is, somebody had a new contribution. And of course, you want to keep my open source contributions and contributors engaged. You want to merge that real quick. You want to make sure it comes out in a release real quick so they send the next patches, right? So we were very busy with, merging reviewing the PR, merging the PR, publishing to NPM. But say this is a module three levels deep into our little Hoodie project, then we had to update the dependency, like a middle dependency, then that needs to be a new NPM publish. And finally, maybe after three or four more iterations, we publish a new version of Hoodie that has that that fix in, or that feature addition in. And we spent all our time doing that management task. And we were really fed up with it real quick. So we realized while splitting things up into many modules has a social benefit, but it comes with management challenges. So we wrote Greenkeeper and Semantic Release, two tools that would basically take away the manual NPM publish and dependency update away from us. And Greenkeeper was we thought was so useful that we told other people about it and they wanted it right away. So we made it into a service that now everybody can use.
So let's back up a bit on Greenkeeper too. And I put the link into the show notes for it. The reason I ran across this was similar to what you're talking about, where I constantly would have these packages that were out of date and I wasn't sure. And sometimes it's not even a security issue. It's just more of I'd like to keep these things up to date with the most modern versions of the dependencies that my code is still using. And a lot of times you don't know, like, I don't know about you, but I don't keep up to date with every single package that's out there. So it'd be nice to kind of keep these things moving. But one of the big concerns I had, and I remember you and I talked about, Jan, early was, what if it updates a package and it actually has an incompatibility? Like, how does Greenkeeper manage that for you?
Well, it doesn't insofar as it only shows you that that's the case. Greenkeeper is built around the idea that you have good testing for your apps. And what it will do is listen to the NPM registry and know when one of your dependencies gets a new version update. And then it'll create a branch on your GitHub, run CI on that. And I know we're going to talk about CI a little bit. Run CI, wait for the CI status and say, hey, this is green. We can open a PR. You can update this. Your test still runs, so we assume this version update didn't break anything. Move along. But it could also be that the CI status comes back red. It says there was an incompatibility. Something didn't work here. You have to check that out. And then what Greenkeeper does for you is it already has created the branch that you can then work on to address the fix. Maybe you have to change your API a little bit. Maybe you have to do something else to make it work. Maybe you just have to restart the PR by the CI build. Sometimes it's just that, right? But it gives you a starting point that is integrated in your regular development environment. You don't have to go hunt for updates. You don't have to go manually look through commits and release notes if they exist, God forbid, to do all this. But when all these things go well, Greenkeeper gives you the merge button with all the context info, like a list of all the commits that came in for that version, so you can see, oh, is there anything that's dangerous? Is there anything that's new? Is this a security update? So I know I have to do this quickly, or can I defer this a little bit? That kind of stuff. So it basically does all the boring stuff, the chores for you. So you as a developer can then decide, I want to merge this or I don't want to merge this.
So let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
If you're looking for a better way to track your product and engineering backlog, and you want a project management tool that's both powerful and simple to use, try Clubhouse. Designed for software teams, Clubhouse comes with a robust REST API and a host of integrations to fit right into your workflow. Go to clubhouse.io/realtalkjs and get 2 months free. Again, that's clubhouse.io/realtalkjs.
And we're back. And Dan, you were about to say something?
Yeah, so I'm assuming then, Jan, this is something that if I have whether it's a private repo or public, you know, it could be GitHub, could be Bitbucket or whatever it may be. It would work anywhere because it's open source, right?
So we currently only work on GitHub and only on JavaScript. The problem with the other code hosting services is that their APIs that we need aren't as well fleshed out as the GitHub ones are.
Yeah, good to know. Okay,
It's a bit tricky. We'll get there eventually. We'll work with those vendors as well. But it works. It's free for open source. So it's free for if your code is on a public repo. We don't actually care if it's open source or not. You can just use it for free. And if you have a private organization or private repos, we charge a little bit, of course. But that's how we keep the lights on.
So let me divert this a little bit to an example so folks who are following along can give this a try. I put a link into the show notes to an example of a pull request that Greenkeeper made on my VS Code extension Peacock. It's a repo up in GitHub. It's pull request 190 here. And just looking along with kind of what it did, Greenkeeper created a branch called Greenkeeper at types node 12.0.11. Which is obviously updating the thing. So in the name of the branch, it actually creates kind of what it's looking at. So it detected that the dependency of types/node was no longer the current version that seems to be out. And it gives you a little bit of a description in there. It says the version is not covered by your current version range. And it kind of tells you what will happen if you do or don't accept this pull request. And there's a little bit of like FAQ stuff and some links down there. But the real key is, I ignored this pull request for, looks like 7 days, and because I was on vacation. And when I came back and looked here, I noticed now that there are multiple comments and looks like commits in here. So it looks like maybe the version updated itself after the fact. Is that something that it does automatically, Jan?
So Greenkeeper is very strictly in the camp of, we do all the boring work for you, but you make decisions. So we'll never touch master. We never merge PRs for you. We'll just make it very easy for you to do an update. if you choose to delay an update, because either you know, oh, that's an incompatibility, I have to think through that a little bit further before I merge it, or I'm on vacation, I'll do this later, or it's not important, I do this later. It's mm-hmm. all of these are fine and absolutely normal developer realities. We don't expect anyone to do this every day. You see in the time you left that open, 12.0.11 came out, then 12.0.12, then 12.6.0, 12.6.1, and so on. And we tested all of them and see if any of those worked for you. And you can now choose to update to any specific one of those. So you can update the original one, or you can merge, you can open a PR and merge the latest one if you wanted to. You don't have to worry about it specifically, but it all happens within a single issue on GitHub, so we don't have to spam you with too many issues.
Yeah, that's something I really liked in this. And I didn't realize it before because I had never ignored it for a week. But when I noticed that I could literally update to any one of those versions based upon this PR by clicking a link that you all provide, but it doesn't create multiple PRs. And to me, that was important because why would I want to have five PRs, one for each version, when it's really not a multiple choice option where you want one of any of these five. So I thought that was neat.
That's one thing here that isn't shown in this one, but say the 12.0.12 update, we figured out that CI said this broke the build. What you would then get, instead of you can update to this version instead, you would get a comment that says, pin your dependency to and we find out which one worked the latest, which would be 12.0.11, that you can say, pin that particular dependency for the moment just to keep my build going and green until I have time to figure this out, which this is how I mostly use Greenkeeper, is if it alerts me that something's wrong. So I'm like, stop, it goes in the next sprint. I'll look at it next Monday. I know that I have process for this, but also the build needs to stay green until then so I can pin it until then.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to one that did break in my history just so people can see what happened for that, because I have had one or two where Greenkeeper says, update to this, but the build did not pass. So I think it might be interesting for people to see. So in the end, that it's been really great for me because I haven't had to worry about that kind of stuff. And it also helped me out with some of the updates for testing libraries that I use, because I forget which library it was, but one of them was using tar way down in a dependency chain. And there was a vulnerability in that for a couple of weeks, and it was a downstream dependency. So once that thing got updated, Greenkeeper actually picked up the high-level dependency that updated itself and made the PR for me, which I thought was fantastic.
It's nice, yeah.
Nice.
One thing I know is probably going to be asked by some folks that use GitHub a lot, and Jan, you'll have to say if this is a sensitive subject or not, but is the Dependabot option. Can you talk about some of the differences between kind of what they do versus what Greenkeeper does there?
You're talking about the Dependabot from GitHub, Dan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So Dependabot started out as a direct competitor to what we did with Greenkeeper. While Greenkeeper wasn't the first service to offer version updates in an automated way, that was, name eludes me, like 4 or 5 years ago, there was one for Ruby. But they did things in a very peculiar way that kind of didn't work for us. One of the important things that how all the modern versions work is, or the variants of this work, is that each dependency is updated individually, because you need to know which, like one of the old problems is like you have 10 things are out of date, you update all of them, your build is broken, which of them broke the build? And usually this means you halt your, like the next development sprint is figuring that out. And that's like 2 to 4 weeks every couple of months is extremely expensive. So we say do this continuously and you will never have the, and individually specifically, and you never have to do pull the handbrake to get some build going again. So we pioneered kind of that format, pioneered a lot of the what we just talked about, how it actually functions. And then two very nice students from London said, this is all very nice, we want this for other languages as well. And if I remember correctly, they started out with Ruby and JavaScript, and have since added a bunch of languages where, in fact, they have leapfrogged our feature set. But they made subtle changes in how all of this works that work better for their... we work across multiple ecosystems where we are very much married to the Node and NPM ecosystem, or the larger JavaScript ecosystem.
Real focused, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's like we want to be like 150% JavaScript instead of the 80% everyone or 50% everyone.
Yeah, makes
sense. That's not to say we'll not ever grow out of this. But we're currently like, there's still ways to go to make this really, really tight. And like, we're talking with the Node Project and with the new founded JS Foundation to like come up with standards around this, about like node adoption. But a bunch of stuff that is still to be done. Anyway, a couple of weeks, months ago, I think, as far as I can tell from the outside, GitHub decided that hiring two students with a successful project is cheaper than R&D and recruiting. So they bought Dependabot and made it free as an add-on. And they took one of the features of Dependabot, which is hot patching log files, made that part of the default service of GitHub. So now we have a competitor that's completely free, which is stressful in one regard, but then we're openly a small company. We've never taken venture capital. We're not here to do a free and figure out business case later project. So we strongly believe that there's enough people who believe in that kind of a business model that isn't leading to, well, we'll be sold to so-and-so and then the service gets shut down and we're done here.
Yeah.
And there's just enough folks that are fed up with that kind of story. And we're here to prove that it's possible to do differently.
And interestingly here too, it looks like I'm reading an article, Dependabot's joining GitHub. I'll put a link to this. It was on May 23rd of this year, 2019. It looks like a lot of this hasn't fully flushed itself out yet. So this has been pretty recent. So I'm assuming then you can't go directly to GitHub and use Dependabot yet.
No, you can. So it's still a marketplace app.
Oh, it's in the marketplace. Gotcha.
Right. So you can just install it, but they won't charge you anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The GitHub marketplace, if folks haven't checked that out, it's actually really cool. There's beyond, Dependabot, there's tons of really cool things that you can go to the marketplace and add, including Azure DevOps and things like that, which is what I use it for. But definitely check out the marketplace if you haven't gone there.
Well, and I appreciate your discussion, Jan, on the just, this is a little off topic, but your whole business model, because I'm with you on, I'm pretty fed up with these people that, oh, we're going to do a company that makes no money and hope we get bought, and then the project just dies and we're all kind of screwed if we used it. Whereas your approach is, no, we can do this on our own. And I like that, actually.
Yeah, frankly, I've enjoyed the Greenkeeper experience so far. And I'm going to hit you some questions of my initial experience using this, Jan, as I went in. And some of these things may not be fair, but keep in mind, I am a skim reader as I look at websites. So,
a skim reader.
Yes. So when it says read the manual, that's usually me. But so when I first went to it, the first thing I thought was, okay, well, it says pricing. This thing must cost me money. And turns out that, within a couple seconds, I figured out, okay, it's totally free for open source projects, which I found was great because that's exactly what I wanted to use it for. Are there any exceptions to that for open source?
Not really, no. We have, the exceptions are usually on the other way around. Like school or a nonprofit organization will ask us, hey, we're doing something for the public good, which could be considered open source, but our product isn't the software. Can we use Greenkeeper for free? And like, if you work for a nonprofit, please get in touch. We're happy to comp a Greenkeeper subscription for you. But other than that, we're set up to support all NPM packages. If all of them would enable Greenkeeper on their GitHub, we could support that in our free to use open source model if you want it. So everybody's invited.
And the organization plan is the one that costs money. So, I mean, it makes sense. You're charging a business, you want to charge money for it.
Right. But only like if you have an organization with just public repos, that's free too. Only if you want to use private repos.
That's a good point. Yeah. So then once I started using this, I signed up for it. And if I remember my experience, I created an account. I used some social media login, I think. I think I used my GitHub account to log in, if I remember correctly. And then it basically said, hey, give me permissions to go look at your GitHub repos. And I said, okay. And I think I selected 4 repos to start because I have like 120. And I'm like, let me try this out in 4. And immediately it barked at me because it said, you don't have CI set up in these repos. You're a bad man.
Yes.
I then came running to Jan going, why? I immediately said, you know what? It's time for me to create CI on one of these because it was really important anyway. So I went ahead and created a CI process of building a new repo at the time for Peacock, my VS Code extension. So I put it on there. Created its own branches, it ran its own stuff, it runs my tests, But what I really liked is it'll run any CI process that you're connected to, whether it's Travis or CircleCI, Azure DevOps. That part I really liked. What I didn't understand, and I'm not entirely sure I do now, is what if I don't have CI? Like, why not support having a repo and create the PR? And if there is no CI, just tell people, look, you know, merge at your own risk.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I have a very elaborate answer to this. So please, please indulge me.
Go for it.
So this isn't specifically about we have strong opinions about how you should write software. Because at the end, we shouldn't care. Like, you should, like, the NPM is only so the success as successful as it is because it started codifying the things that people were doing anyway. So I think that's a tremendous, like, design objective. The counterpoint is the Greenkeeper team is very tiny, and making a project that does a lot of things and is very configurable is complex. And there's only so much complexity that we can support that would slow down feature development, would slow down bug fixing, or would be problematic at scale. And so one of the product design features that we have is we'd rather have a decent default than giving people an option to do something. And the older we get and the more stuff we do, the more we get away from this. And that is also like normal for software development. But we make very, very hard decisions about what kind of options we allow. And if it means people who don't have CI can't use Greenkeeper, then it's like, maybe you're not at that software development stage where you need a tool like Greenkeeper, and that's totally fine. On the other hand, that particular feature request about like skip CI true or something in our configuration, which we have, is something that today I would support. Maybe 2-3 years when we made those design decisions, when we're still like a lot of the stuff was still trying out and settling, we were maybe a little bit more strict. But at that, and like today, I would say, we should have that option.
Well, John, you can just enable CI on those others. You don't have any tests anyway, so it's
that's true.
Quick CI.
To be clear, just people don't think I'm an awful person. The ones I was testing on originally were demos that I ran at, like, you know, presentations and workshops and things like that. And while they should have tests, quite frankly, sometimes, you know, I do not put tests in place.
Tests are for people who make mistakes, John.
But for like my VS Code, like for full open source that I have, you know, thousands of people using, then those things I create tests on, because, which is why it was a motivator for me anyway at the time for that extension, which definitely helped me out.
You're welcome.
What can I say today? You're welcome.
Also, shout out to Peacock from the Greenkeeper development team. They asked me to relay this when we saw this when it came out, and they jumped on it right away because except for me, all of them are using code, so it's very much appreciated that you did that.
Yep, you're one of those text pad people. That's it, right?
Notepad,
whatever. Yeah.
Text pad, notepad. Ward, what do you use for a computer again?
WordPro, nice.
WordStar, one of those, you know.
Oh my gosh. So one of the things that I want to get into with Greenkeeper too is, like, you mentioned at the bottom of your page things like, or at least some of the pages I've seen with it, like Sneak, SNYK, NPM Audit Fix is another thing. These aren't exactly the same thing, obviously. But what do you recommend people do if they're setting up managing their own NPM module dependencies besides Greenkeeper, which I assume you endorse? What else do you recommend people use, and what do you use?
The one other thing that sort of isn't a product but an open source project that we kind of started as well, as I mentioned earlier, is called Semantic Release. It's some, if you run NPM publish a lot, if you publish a library that other people are using, then like the chore around figuring out which is the right version to update, like which, like 12.09, which is the next one. Oh, I committed a bug fix and a feature, and like I have 10 commits to go through, figure out what is the right number. The Semantic Release does that for you. It tags everything for you correctly. It pulls in or it creates release notes from your commits if you use the right format. And you basically never run NPM publish again. You just have a bunch of rules set up on your GitHub that releases come out when your push commits. and it's so hard to explain that people, like, to explain that without like having done it, because like, oh yeah, NPM publish is super easy. Like over a million people have done it, right? Like at least once. It's super, but if you don't have to do it, that's a whole nother level of, oh my God, I don't have to think about this. I don't have to worry about this. And I know the computers are better at like getting the numbers correct in the right format. And like one of the things I always like, literally it happens to me every time I publish something manually, is I tag it in Git and I push it. And then I realize I didn't commit package.json with the version bump. And then I have to tag it, like delete the tag remotely, push it. Like, oh my God. Like take that away, that responsibility away from me. And so that would be the other one. And that exists for other languages as well. So you totally check that out.
So the first thing I thought of when I thought about semantic release, I keep wanting to call it semantic versioning, is what if it does it when I'm not ready for it? Like what if I made a change that was a breaking change in some way that I wasn't ready for? And it sounds like the answer from reading your README, which I admit I'm doing now, is based upon the commit message format. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So you say fix if you want a patch, feature if you want a like a minor feature release. Is that what that is?
Yeah, it's the major minor fix is kind of the names for the version numbers. So if you're breaking changes, update the first number, features the middle one, and fixes the last one.
Okay. That kind of makes sense. I mean, a lot of these different tools, and Ward, you worked with the Angular team a lot, and they had their own commit message format, right?
No, that's the common commit message format or something like that now, but it came from the Angular team, actually, the original one.
Ah, yeah, I see that right in the notes, Angular commit message conventions. Very cool.
That was so that they could at least somewhat auto-generate release notes. You know, it takes you, 80%, and then you go in there and make something that people can really understand.
Well, I saw somebody on Twitter, I forget who it was the other day, it's probably Sindoris, was talking about how he had like 1,200 or 12,000 open PRs at a time or something like that. He was trying to manage them. I was thinking about tools like this when he was talking about that.
Yeah, this GitHub acquired them shortly after Dependabot, called PR Panda, I think. That has, like, when that came out, it's like, okay, we can scrap part of our roadmap. It helps you manage PRs in an organization way rather than in a repo way, and like helps you with getting all that done. I've personally haven't had too much experience with it since they came out, but like this is stuff we thought about a lot as well. It's like, what if all my projects need that Lodash update, and not I don't want to go through every one of them, right? Would be great to merge them all at once. And PR Panda, which is now also free and owned by GitHub and Microsoft, lets you do that as well. So another R&D acquisition hire for GitHub there.
So I'm sensing a trend.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
So what's your position on monorepos versus a bunch of micro repos? I mean, you started this whole thing saying we wanted to have a lot of small node modules, and Greenkeeper kind of emerged as a way to try and manage that. My reaction to that, I'm sure others are like that, is, holy smokes, now how do I make sure that they actually all work together? So there's the management stuff that you're doing, but do they actually work together? And now you talk about distributing potentially, if it's not a monorepo, now these things are all going across multiple repos. Do you have a position on that, on mono versus multi-repo?
It comes back to the, and my diplomatic answer is, tools should adapt to how people use are developing or what they're doing. So when it became clear that monorepos was a thing that people were doing, we added support for it in Greenkeeper. When people were still on the fence about this, we were like, we're also on the fence. Like it's a big change in behavior. So it took us quite a while to build this. But it's table stakes at this point, so you have to have it from a tooling perspective. And I can see some of the benefits as well, especially when it comes to wanting some of the modularity for distribution, but then like in a Lodash sense, I just want to have a sub-Lodash thing here. It might be easier to do that with, make sure it is compatible with everything else in Lodash, but also I can just pull out one thing and can require that and keep my dependencies low, right? Don't get any other insecurities later through code that I'm not actually using, all that kind of, all these kinds of benefits. So I can see the benefits. It's just personally, I haven't run into the I don't write software at that big a scale where that becomes really, really useful. And I think mostly the Yarn and Learner people coming out of Facebook are used to working at really, really big projects where this is a little bit more common. Whereas in a 10-person team, I can still manage a couple dozen modules being interacting. But I've never worked in a 100 or 1,000 person team or project that has that many developers. So I don't want to scoff at what people build to support their workflows.
How do you feel, Ward? Monorepo, single repo, half a repo?
Well, I guess I'm mostly been living in the monorepo world, so I see the primary benefit of having everything hanging together and being tested together. But it's I also see the tooling challenges, and I don't know. I know that the trend is towards monorepo.
I don't think I've ever heard you be so wishy-washy before.
You know, because all it is pain. It's just you move the pain around. It feels like
it's you have to figure out what works for your development teams. And like when you look at Facebook or Google and then figure out all of Google is one big SVN and then all of Facebook is one big Mercurial repo. It's like that is monorepo taken too far probably. And they have a lot of tooling to make sure that works for them, which is like, if you didn't have that big repo, you could not have these whole teams that just do the tooling for the other developers, right? But they made the choice that works for them. It's very successful. I'm not here to argue, but I live in a world of small teams and individual open source developers, and I just don't want to I like small tools like Greenkeeper and PR Panda and other things like that that help me get my job done. But I don't need a whole lot of tooling around my stuff.
Well, I'm with you there. I think these days, if you were to ask me in my younger years, I was all about, the latest shiny thing in the tool shed, if you will. And now I'm like, if you walk into my tool shed, there's very few tools hanging on the wall, figuratively speaking here or visually, because it just, in the end, I've run into too many issues with, as you mentioned, for instance, one of the tools, the company goes out of business. And, you based your whole process on that or something. And so I think there's something to be said about the whole keep it simple, not only with your code, but also with your tool set and your dependencies. John, when we were initially getting on this this morning, you mentioned, the left pad?
Left pad.io, yeah.
And that's kind of worth bringing up here, I think, is, there's just so many scenarios where you install an NPM package because it does some fancy, shiny thing. And then if you actually go look at the code, which I almost always do, especially if I think it is going to be simple, you might be like, I don't really think I need to manage that dependency. I could just manage that code because the code is so minimal. What was LeftPad? 12 lines of code or something? I can't even remember.
I think 11 off the top of my head, but I put a link to it here.
Dan, why did you make me put... What is that thing that I put in an NPM package that you talked about?
Wait. We didn't make you make
you
anything.
You made me, Dan.
I was just going to say, make you. I remember Ward going, hey, I got a great way we could solve that. I'll put it out there.
That's not how I remember is I'll talk about it only if you make an NPM package out of it.
That was we'll talk about it only if you bump it to 1.0 because it was 0.1 or whatever.
Yeah,
remember,
it's subsync, which has 3 lines of code and 50 lines of comments, and that's it. But they're the right 3 lines. That's the key. It's the right 3 lines of code.
So just to interject real quick, I put a LeftPad.io link in there for people. So if you didn't know what LeftPad.io situation we're talking about, you can go check it out. The short story is years ago, somebody owned that package, took it off of NPM, and lots of packages depended upon it, and all hell broke loose. Things have since changed. You can read about it at the link I provided in there. So, sorry, Ward, go ahead.
No, I mean, that. This gets back to the small module doing one thing challenge, which is, which is where you started, Jan, and it certainly has the virtues that you described of, well, at least if I want to go in there and see what it does and maybe even contribute to it, I can actually grok it. I can understand it. Whereas if I want to make a change to, I don't know, React or Angular or something like that, I wouldn't even know where to start, right? So it certainly has those advantages, but then we end up with a long list of these little plugins that we even have to get our heads wrapped around. What's that like for you? I mean, you've lived that world. I haven't. I tend to make bigger libraries than that. What's it feel like to work with lots and lots of little modules that are tightly bounded the way yours are?
It's like the way you think about architecting software changes every time you have a new chance at doing it. And I think what we learned with going very extreme is that may be a little bit too far. Maybe Hoodie didn't have to be 50 modules. Maybe 25 would have been enough. And maybe some of them could have been monorepos to be a little bit more manageable from a tooling perspective, because those tools exist now but didn't back then. So if I were to start out, I would like reevaluate all that real closely again. But then I've identified like a couple of layers. It's like some of the things that typically lives in your lib directory, like, and that needs to be in your lib directory. It's stuff that is tightly integrated to all your code that you're currently working on. But then sometimes you have a thing that is do a smart thing around Markdown, like extract some link so you don't actually accidentally mention a lot of people on GitHub, which you do if you put up the username. And if you open a lot of PRs and put in a username, that user gets millions of mentions, which is something that has happened to us. So we want to be clever around filtering stuff out of Markdown. But turns out, like, not only we need this, other people need that as well. It may even be the competition who needs that, but like other people can make use of that. And while that code is like very tightly integrated into what you need to do, it's also useful standalone. And that would be the first breakoff point where you can say, hey, this is useful to be on its own. Maybe it has a very easy API, like a small API, so I don't have to, like, I publish the 1.0 and then it's done. It's like I don't even have to worry about updating it. People can just grab it and we're good. Or maybe it gets a couple of revisions to support different flavors of Markdown, but then that's done. So that's then you just like continue to think that through. If you like, Hoodie is built on Happy, which is like Express competitor, which I love very, very much. And they're priding themselves that they never have any dependency vulnerabilities these days because they don't have any dependencies. When the downside is they have to write all the code. They have to write all the code. But also it's an HTTP library that the problem space is rather well defined, and they actually they are very careful about not being everything to everyone, but making everything useful, making everything fast and safe by default. And that's also a very interesting thing to say. So I don't even I wouldn't have to go in and build a thing like Happy, but I can just depend on it. And maybe there's a plugin that I need to, like, Happy's builder on plugins so I can do a useful thing and I abstract that out. And that's, again, it's like the Markdown thing. I can make that available to other Happy users that they can opt into that again. It's so hard to say in the abstract what the right way to do this is when you're not having a concrete example that we could talk through. But just be prepared that you go, like, you will bounce between the extremes of putting everything into one place and then seeing the benefit of separating stuff and then seeing the draw of having it extremely separated and then seeing the problems with going back a little bit and then finding your personal equilibrium.
That sounds like a dilemma that we face in just about every aspect of programming. Yeah. From how big should this component be?
Yeah, exactly. It's like how many lines does a function have? How many lines can a method have? How long can a class be? What's the good breaking off point for a class? What's the visibility for internal methods? Why can't I use them in tests? There's so much to talk about here.
And the answer is 300.
Exactly.
With that, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Are you building a web application? Need to deliver it soon and don't have the people to do it? Maybe you're not sure your company has the skill set or experience to do it. And maybe we can help. I'm your host, Ward Bell, and my day job is building applications for companies like yours. I don't do it alone. I'm president of IdeaBlade, a consultancy that specializes in enterprise web application development. We're particularly strong in Angular, RxJS, NGRX Redux on the front end, and .NET and Microsoft technologies on the server. We're a small, tight-knit group of people handpicked by me for their expertise, experience, integrity, and team spirit. Maybe we can help you with architectural guidance and hands-on development. And if there's something we don't know, and in our field, really, there's too much to know, we can draw on our personal connections in the Microsoft RD, MVP, and Google GDE networks, as well as our international circle of really great developers, people we know and trust personally. If you got a project that's keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at info@ideablade.com. That's info@ideablade.com. And now back to the show.
Yeah, and getting back to the LeftPad IO for just a moment, one of the things that, man, I get torn on this, and I find this is a great example of it, but I'm not exactly sure what to do, and I'd like your opinion. I'm using LeftPad IO somewhere. I know I am. I mean, we all are somewhere. It's got 3.3 million weekly downloads, which is astonishing, right? And the thing is, more than 11 lines of code. I linked to the source code in the notes. People can check it out. But still, it's effectively just padding the left of a string with spaces. What I love about what the owner has done since then is this person has marked a repo as read-only. So it's effectively, you know, indicated this thing's no longer being updated. And then also with NPM, and I put the link to how you can do this in the show notes, has deprecated the NPM package, which then posts this very clear red-pink message up on NPM that says the package has been deprecated. And the author's message is use string.prototype.padstart. Which I think is awesome. I mean, it's like, hey, use JavaScript at this point. But here's the question. I'm using LeftPad somewhere. How do I know if something's been deprecated? And then how do I know what to do once it has been?
Well, the deprecation shows up when you run npm install, which we went through. You only do occasionally, right? And you usually, like, it runs when you do CI or deploys, but you usually don't look through the npm install log.
Wait, you're telling me I have to look at those messages that come out?
No. Definitely do not look at the message. No. There's one more complication for it. It is usually not your direct dependency, but some sub dependency, and getting that module chain updated is not something that is even in your control or worth your time. And that's why there are the 3 million downloads a week. The downside of, like, the flip side, maybe, is if you do browser JavaScript, it's like, start using this feature, and everybody's, yeah, great, I would, but I have to support browser so-and-so, and that doesn't have it yet, or doesn't
like,
have it.
Like IE, that's the problem with a string.prototype padstart.
I wasn't going to bring up any particular browser, but
you're safe.
They are all guilty of one or other thing that they don't support. And then you have to look at what's the baseline that I need to support. Where do I need polyfills for what? Maybe I have my server can dynamically decide which polyfills I need by parsing the user agent string. Like there's a lot of stuff that you can be clever about and maybe send ES6 and the pad string, the pad start to browsers that support it, but send the left pad thing to all the ones that don't. I work that way. I personally work more on the server CLI side, but maybe I'm building a package that I want lots of people to use and install, and maybe that's still on node 4 or node 6 or node 8, which gets deprecated later this year. And I know while node gets deprecated, I know that's still going to be running for a couple of years, and that's never going to get that new feature. So I'll just stay with this for a while, even though maybe all new development happens on node 12 and eventually maybe you just have to update. But there's always like find your target platform, make a conscious decision about who you exclude or include by requiring certain versions and what it's mostly social impacts. Like if you're okay, you can leave out all IE users. Well, that probably means a lot of people in public service can't use your website because they're just... they're still in that world. That may be okay for you. That might not be okay for you. Somebody has to make that decision. But I'm not here to tell you which one to do. On the other hand,
that's for Ward. So
right,
exactly.
Sorry,
that's my job.
Good. I apologize. On the other hand, it's like This is basically the flip side. Maybe another thing that you should have a podcast about is Anthropic, the new NPM alternative registry. They were recently, like last week, discussing what is the node version that we should be targeting. Should it be 8? Should it be 10? Should it be 12? Which is the current one, I think, if I remember correctly. I should know this. The answer was, and rightfully so, was target the latest one today because we don't anticipate Anthropic to be done by the time like 8 is still supported or 10 is still supported. So if you're working towards the future, stay in that future as long as you can before you have to degrade back or have to put in polyfills later. So depending on where your project is, what kind of target you need to hit, and what your development timeline is. If you like, Node is pretty upfront about when they ship what, and it's pretty clear what feature set in terms of language features are supported at which point. If you know you're going to ship when Node 12 hits LTS or when Node 14 hits LTS, that's your target.
Circling back to Green Keeper, does it treat exploring the major version bump the same way it would, say, a minor or a patch bump?
Green Keeper doesn't care one way or the other.
So does it just sort of try, like, if there's a sudden, 6.0 of whatever I was using, and it was obviously not in the range I specified in package JSON, do you sort of say, well, I'll fire this up and run your tests and see if it works? Does that? So yeah, it really doesn't care what the version is.
Right. It behaves slightly differently, especially if you specify version ranges as dependencies. And there's one thing we call real-time dependency update breakage detection, which is
That's a tongue twister.
Right. Well, we're a German company, so we're used to this.
Ah, okay.
Good one. The idea here is if you depend on tilde 5.6.0, then everything whatever comes after 5 is fair game for you. What we do is like I said, like when new version 5 something comes out, we create the branch, we see if CI works. If it works and we know the current, like the version that just came out, is within your range.
You're not gonna nag me.
We'll just delete the branch. And it's our number one support question is, I see Greenkeeper creating branches and then deleting branches.
Yeah.
Why? And it's the number one in our FAQ as well. It's like, it just proved that semantic versioning actually works or worked in this case, and everything is fine. And that's actually very neat. Like, we didn't do that for a while, and people were really annoyed by getting every minor version update there. There's a downside to this now that log files become a little bit more popular. You still want to bump those, but then you wouldn't have to do this. And you can be a little bit more lenient during development here. But if you're strict about log files, then that's you get a bump for everyone one of those versions, which can be a little bit annoying. So. Depending on what your specific needs are there. Using a tool that automatically on release time checks whether you're still compatible kind of obviates the needs for log files. But I also understand that on a, when you want to go and deploy stuff, that you want to make sure it's exactly the things that we specified.
It only obviates it if you feel like you have the world's greatest test coverage, which none of us.
Right.
I mean, none of us are ever satisfied.
Yeah. Fair point.
None of us are ever satisfied.
Yep. No, that's a very, very good point.
So Jan, this has been a fantastic episode. And before we started this up, I know we wanted to invite you back on. We already talked about that with you. So I'd like to officially ask you to come back on. And there's so many other topics that we talked about before the show. And maybe you can come back on in a couple weeks or so and talk about them with us.
Yeah, I'm happy to come back anytime. This was fun.
And I was furiously typing in links to pretty much everything I hope that you mentioned in the show notes. So hopefully I caught all those for all the listeners out there who want to catch up on them. One more I'm going to mention real quick because I just typed it in there is there's a thing called CodeKitten. If you've ever wondered what version of Node is coming out or when a version has been released or what it's involved with it, there's actually a bot that Tierney Siren has put together using Azure Functions. It's up on Twitter. You can follow at NodeKitten on Twitter and it will let you know when a new version of Node is out. So while this isn't automated for GitHub or whatever, it is nice to just let you know.
Kitten? You think of kitten? I just don't. Whatever.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I guess they just realized that that's a grabber. That's a link.
So this is the only name in JavaScript you've ever thought was weird? Have you not been in JavaScript for all of your life?
You know, I always love you'll rip off gulp, grunt, broccoli, and then I'll throw in like brunch. And I'm like, no, I made that up, but it would work. You know?
Yeah, it probably exists too.
It probably does exist.
Well, at least peacock made sense as a animal totem. Okay, I am done. I'm done.
I just thought that was funny. So yeah, Tierney does a great job, and he's kind of made it his personal mission to let people know about Node versions, and I applaud him for that. So that's great.
Sorry, brunch has 13,000 weekly downloads.
Brunch.
See?
Dang, that was my next project. I can't use it now.
You know, extra points, anyone who creates WordBell.js.
Brunch Kitten is available there.
Brunch Kitten.
Oh my gosh.
You know, there's probably literally an NPM like naming. Well, you know, NPM has their own, or they used to have that random thing, but it's probably a naming tool.
Yeah, I think there's multiple of those even because NPM.
Jan, thanks again for coming. And at the end of the show, we like to do a quick segment called Someone to Follow. And this is a point where each of us calls out somebody who's inspired us in this industry, or maybe even just a cool article or open source tool that we want to point people to. I'll start off with Dan. Who is your someone to follow?
You know, actually, I'm going to go with a tool because I thought it was awesome. I'll put this in the show note links and all that. But
you going to tell us the name of the tool?
No, I wouldn't.
It's awesome, though.
It's so awesome that I don't even need to say. That's the name. It's called Awesome.
Fantastic.
So awesome. So no, awesome kitten. Awesome kitten.
Awesome kitten. There you go. That's probably taken, Ward. Sorry, you can't use that. It's Base16 terminal colors, which doesn't sound very cool. But if you do use VS Code, so Jan, this isn't for you, obviously, because we know your love for Notepad, was it? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. But it allows you, they have these themes for really tricking out your console in VS Code. And we'll put a link in there. And it's a really nice website, though. Somebody put some good work into this. Let me see. They might have a glitch. Oh, that's right. I did look at the Twitter account. And so anyway, very cool to check out. Check out the show notes and there'll be a link there.
Cool. And Ward, who is your someone to follow? I shudder to ask.
Well, you should shudder. Her name is Simone and spelled G-I-E-R-T-Z, which, of course, is pronounced Yatch. How can that be? Because she's Swedish. She is known as the Queen of Shitty Robots. She's on YouTube. She's fantastic. Creates these amazing robots that will ruin your life. I just stumbled into her because she bought a brand new Model 3 Tesla and cut the back off and turned it into an El Camino pickup truck. she has gotten wide coverage. I don't know how I hadn't met her before, but definitely worth your while watching her do her stuff and come up with crazy solutions to everyday life.
Jan, who's your someone to follow?
In case someone didn't listen to episode 20 of your podcast, I'm re-recommending Kat Marchand, maybe Kat's on Twitter, Zcat on GitHub. A fantastic person to follow. Plus, they just left NPM and are now being, in part, funded by GitHub donations. So you should go and donate.
Yeah, Kat did leave recently. I don't know how recently is, but by the time we air, but... there's about a couple of people who left there, and there's some good folks out there doing some new things. I'm actually looking forward to seeing what a lot of them do in their new jobs.
Make sure to have them on again.
I'm a big fan of that episode.
Kat was amazing on the show.
Kat impressed, and it's really important that Kat get the next thing going.
Yes.
So my someone to follow is actually two people. One of them is Jonathan Carter, and the other one's Eric Gamma. I've mentioned Eric before, I believe. Jonathan is one of the main folks driving the extension for LiveShare for VS Code. And he recently, him and his team, made a pull request to Peacock to make it such that when you're sharing that you can actually change the color of yours or somebody else's VS Code to make it work. So I was really appreciative that they made a cool open source request for that. And then also Eric Gamma, who's done so many amazing things, but recently he helped create a pull request on Peacock that I'm reviewing right now for making Peacock work with remote extensions for Visual Studio Code. And if you haven't checked out the remote extension, the extension pack for VS Code, you absolutely need to. And Dan, you would love this if you haven't seen it. Have you seen it yet?
Is this the thing Anthony just tweeted about where I can set up a Docker container? Oh, yeah. I read his post
Anthony
last
Chu,
night.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was amazing. I'm like, wow, that is freaking awesome.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, I won't spoil everything, but basically you can use VS Code to tap directly into any SSH remote source code. Or you could tap directly into a Docker container from VS Code using this extension. So it's pretty cool stuff. And it's I've just been honored that these folks have been able to tap their extensions into Peacock and take advantage of the coloring of that too. So pretty cool stuff. And definitely check out Eric and Jonathan. They do some great things out there. Jan, thanks for coming again. And we'll definitely invite you back. Stay with us after we stop recording here. And for all of you, thank you for listening, and we'll see you every Tuesday morning on Real Talk JavaScript.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter at Real Talk JS.